This is Sivan Zamir, head of early stage innovation and venture at Xylem. Get ready to learn from phenomenal waterpreneurs as you listen to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market leading companies and organizations: by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by 1898 & Co, possibilities powered by experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; and by the American Waterworks Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. This is Session 260.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGibson and thank you for joining me. And thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. Before we head off for our summer hiatus, yes, that's right. No podcast will be released in July. We leave you with a fantastic interview by Jonathan Haswell, the Chief Business Officer of Oceanwell. What is Oceanwell, you ask? Well, in a nutshell, it's desalination reimagined with lower energy usage and significantly reduced environmental impact. So buckle up. For those wondering why Reese Tisdale and I couldn't connect at the beginning of June, but somehow found time to connect for a Bluefield on Tap episode during the week of ACE, well, that's just one of life's great mysteries. On this week's Bluefield on Tap, Reese discusses the recently announced divergence of DuPont's business units. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some fantastic sponsors. Our sponsorship lineup includes Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co, Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Waterworks Association, and that is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education, and I thank you all. And I'd like for you, the listener, to please do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and will help others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, someone once told me that that's kind of an important thing. Well, before we head on to the fantastic interview that Jonathan Haswell of Oceanwell delivers, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale, talking about the pending DuPont spinoffs. So take it away, guys. Well, Reese, welcome back to another Bluefield on Tap. We missed you at the beginning of June, and now we're picking you up at the tail end. So how you been?
I've been pretty good. Thanks for bringing me back. I thought if I'd skipped last time, you'd never hear from me again, but I really do appreciate it. And to that point, I had a dinner meeting with some industry executives and people in the market, and they said, oh, I've heard your voice before. I heard you on the Water Values Podcast. So there you go.
Yeah, there we go. It's more than just my mom downloading. So
exactly.
So ACE just wrapped up. Lots of big news in the water sector, but what has risen to the top of your stack this month?
Well, I'm not going to lie. ACE is on my mind, but I wasn't there. For good and bad, but I haven't gotten the full report, so maybe next time we could circle up on that. But what has been going through my mind this past week, actually, is I've been doing some work on sort of looking at the top companies in water. Every quarter we look at about 50 or so publicly traded companies. And one thing jumped out at me was the recent DuPont announcement that it was going to split out of its water business. It's going to split into three companies, one of which is water. So kind of excited about that. But sort of aligns with some other activity we're seeing in the market as well.
Yeah. So what are the segments that it's splitting into? How is it being divvied up?
Yeah. So I mean, it's basically a $12 billion company, and so it's really breaking into three different segments. And I think there are a number of reasons for this, but one is water, as I mentioned. The other will be electric. And then the other will be the new DuPont, which is sort of, I guess, a core group of businesses or focus, which is things like healthcare and other industries, which are in many respects faster growing as well.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So we've seen a lot of convergence around water. This feels like it's a divergence. And I'm curious if it's you just see this as a cyclical thing, or is this something, a harbinger of greater, maybe let's just call it impatience with profits in the water sector?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's really what got me excited. So just for context, actually in the case of DuPont, it just merged with Dow in 2017. So it's, and I think the idea was, hey, with scale, we'll have, bigger, better opportunities going forward. And now we're splitting it up again. I think there are a number of different reasons for the split up. And I think you could also look at Danaher as well, which spun out Veralto in 2023. So you've got these large conglomerates, or diversified companies. They have different, each business unit, they're growing at different paces, particularly if you've got businesses that are focused on things like healthcare, biotech. Those are growing at a much faster rate than, let's say, water. So I think one aspect of their approach is, hey, let's allow these businesses to focus on what they do at their own pace, at their own speed. So I think the sum of the parts, is it stronger than all the individual pieces? In this case, I don't think so. I think breaking them up does benefit shareholders. So I think obviously they're publicly traded, focus on shareholders. In the case of water, it is a different business. It's a little bit, the pace is different. You've got municipal and industrial sectors. It's a little bit harder in some respects. But what this does do is allow the standalone companies like Xylem, which was spun out of ITT a while back. You've got Danaher and spinning out Veralto. And now you'll have the new DuPont water business. It allows them to focus on their own strategies, do their own M&A, kind of fund their own businesses, and not be overshadowed by these other business units. So I'm actually, one could be negative on it. I'm actually really positive about it because I think it also speaks well for the sector as a whole.
Yeah. So essentially, rather than being beholden to maybe other interests of a company, they become just focused on water. So the divergence in this case is actually a very positive sign.
Yeah, I think so. I think water is also increasingly, just in the time that we've owned Bluefield Research, is that it has, you can feel the push towards water. There's more discussion, whether it be in the day-to-day. And rather than being treated as a stepchild, and I am a stepchild, so I'm okay with that term. So they get to stand on their own. So I'm excited about that.
All right, so that begs the next question is kind of what is DuPont's water business, and where do you see the opportunities, or where is the market seeing the opportunities maybe for DuPont?
Yeah, I think for DuPont as a standalone, it's actually fairly well positioned in the market going forward, given what we're seeing. One is just water quality as a whole. I mean, DuPont really is focused on advanced water treatment with things like reverse osmosis technology, ion exchange, filtration, and its focus is on, and it's pretty diversified. So it's looking at or supporting industrial and energy sector. That's about half of its business. But it's also focused on life sciences, muni and desal, which is about 20% of its business. Then also a small share, less than 10%, is residential and commercial. So it's fairly well diversified from a customer and business sector base. But also, I think it gets at sort of water supply treatment, but also treatment overall when things like lead and PFAS are in the water. There's a big opportunity going forward.
So it sounds like they're going to be taking advantage of new regulations as well as just their natural focus on the water sector as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like I said, as a standalone, now they can focus on it, not have to explain themselves to a board that's also interested in a lot of other things.
Awesome. Well, Reese, always great to talk with you. Fantastic information. And I really look forward to seeing how the DuPont spinoff impacts the water sector. It's going to be interesting times.
Sure. I thought you were going to say something about the Boston Celtics.
The NBA? What's the NBA?
Exactly. Call me tomorrow or in the next couple of days and I'll let you know.
Well, the Celtics swept the Pacers. You know, my NBA team is the Sonics, but they don't exist anymore. So,
well, you got the Thunder. So.
Hey, I think the Sonics are going to be coming back at some point.
I think so.
Yeah. All right. Well, Reese, always great speaking with you. Hope you have a great summer. We'll be back for August. So we'll take our summer hiatus and we'll see you again soon.
Awesome. Look forward to it. Enjoy the month of July.
Amen. All right. We'll see you, Reese.
See ya.
Bye. As always, great information from the Bluefield Research team and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with the tremendous Jonathan Haswell. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Jonathan, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Fantastic to have you on today. How are you?
I'm doing well, Dave. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. But before we get to that, how about letting us know a thumbnail on your background and how you even came to the water sector?
Sure. So I'm new to the water sector. I've been only 2 years in this industry. Prior to that, I spent 15 years in the automotive technology space and built three businesses there in three chapters, starting in software with motorsport simulation, then moving into motorsport operations, and finally converging my hardware operations experience and software, supporting some of the self-driving car companies such as Waymo in their test fleet operations as they bring that technology to market. And I finished that journey in 2020 when I sold my business and spent a year off thinking about what's next and where I would like to build. And spent a lot of time looking at climate and found myself to water and learned a lot about the hydrological cycle and how the climate problem is oftentimes a water problem.
Yeah, that sounds like a fascinating background. Can you tell us how did you make the jump from the automotive sector? Granted, you had a hiatus period there, but what caused you to pick up on water in terms of its role in climate?
Well, in 2017, I had a very personal experience with a wildfire in Northern California, which taught me and my business firsthand the effects of climate change. And really that opened my mind to the power of this problem that we're faced with. And so started digging in, started learning more about climate and how I could make a contribution to the climate transition, and zeroed in on water because wildfires had become such a big part of my recent journey. And I had learned that wildfires were a hydrological cycle problem. And so then started having a lot of conversations with colleagues and friends, trying to find an entry point to the industry. And to start with, I actually wasn't looking at water at all. I was looking in all sorts of other areas, but wanted to find a technology, a cause, a team that was really going to work on something that would move the needle, because I was aware that any of the technologies here that are going to have meaningful impact to water or climate on a larger scale are going to take some time to bring to fruition. And really, you want to plan for a 10, 15 year journey there. So my view was playing with race cars and video games had been an awful lot of fun. But now I'm a father too, and parents look at life slightly differently. And if I'm going to go on another startup journey, I want to do something that has a little more impact potential. So that's how I found my way into the sector. I was very fortunate along that journey to meet a gentleman called Charles McGarrah, who actually was a friend and is now a colleague at Ocean Well. And he was very generous to be a thought partner in that year off that I took, as we were exploring some of the themes and areas that might be interesting to build in and to help support. And through that process, I learned that he was an expert on water and in fact had been developing what we now refer to as Ocean Well. So that's how I went from race cars into water.
Wow, that's quite a story. I would So you've mentioned where you've landed now. So you're at Ocean Well.
Yes. And
the next obvious question is, what is Ocean Well?
Indeed. Ocean Well is a new approach to desalination. So Ocean Well takes the key insight that sufficient pressure to run a conventional reverse osmosis process exists for free in the deep ocean. And we can access that pressure at about 400 meters of depth. So if you could build a desalination facility at that depth, you can substantially reduce the energy required to power a reverse osmosis process. And that's the key insight that has started the 7-year journey for Ocean Well, which commenced, as I said, 7 years ago by Robert Bergstrom, who funded some research and studies into this space, and then met our CTO co-founder, Dr. Michael Porter, who together over the last 4 years have productized what we now refer to as the Ocean Well, which is this cylindrical pod that we place at 400 meter depth and leverage the hydrostatic pressure of the deep ocean to suck instead of push water through a conventional RO process. So if you imagine in your mind's eye a very large pod about 8 meters wide, suspended a few meters above the seabed with a large pipe going into it and then a large pipe going out of it, that is what a single Ocean Well pod looks like. And the units suck water in through the cylinder from all sides and push that water through a conventional process. The outfall then goes through the top of the Ocean Well pipe through what we refer to as our brine riser outfall. And the product water, the fresh water, is sent down through the bottom into a manifold and pushed back to shore. And by placing these pods in this location, we not only get a substantial energy reduction, which is material that can be in the range 30 to 50%, depending on the size of the water farm, the configuration, the bathymetry, and some other factors, we receive a number of other benefits that have historically been problematic for desalination and its wide-scale use. And that is the outfall of brine that is typically associated with desalination, marine life mortality, and the need for a factory on the coastline, typically in a place where you don't want to build a big plant. And the way the technology avoids those challenges is the depth we're at is called the aphotic zone. And this is the depth 200 meters and below, where less than 1% of sunlight reaches, which means we have limited opportunity for photosynthesis, limited opportunity for things to grow. And so the order of magnitude problem that we have in terms of dealing with marine life, and so marine life mortality, is substantially reduced.
Can you tell us a little about how these water farms, the Ocean Well system, operates from a technical perspective? You know, without, obviously, we don't want to get too deep into the algae, so to speak, but if you could just let us know.
Well, your algae reference is a good one, because one of the key features of the Ocean Well system is its baseload supply reliability. So by being so deep in the ocean, you avoid algae blooms and other challenges like that conventional desalination plants can encounter. But there's a few other sort of side benefits to the system that are worth discussing as we bring it to its first applications here in California and elsewhere. And that's, there is an interesting byproduct that could be used by these communities, which is extremely cold water. And that itself could have applications for cooling if the community that's using the water farm has applications for those. In fact, from a raw commercial perspective, the cooling is more valuable oftentimes than the water, though our mission is solving water scarcity, so we tend not to focus too much on that. Another very elegant piece of the system is that we don't use any chemicals at all in the process. And so that helps us keep the system a clean, environmentally safe source for fresh water. So the other point that's worth considering here from this source of water is that the water itself is borehole safe. So it's useful if there are agricultural applications near the location. Of course, we are a coastal solution fundamentally. Although as we move down our journey, we will start looking at things like legal water exchange so that we can have impact further into the interior of the country. Added to that, we have what's called a life-safe cross-flow intake system, which is a mechanical evacuation system to move out any life forms that are brought in to into the ocean well system.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. So energy savings, reduced impact of brine contamination or flow.
Yep.
Curious, so you said the aphotic zone is 200 meters or less. You've talked about 400 meters. Is there something magical about 400 meters? Why that depth?
Yep, so that's the depth at which we find the bar pressure we need to run the RO process. So that's why 400 meters. It can be sort of 400 to 450, depending on the specific water. But generally speaking, that's where we want the side of the pod to be located.
Got it. And how far out to sea do you have to sight these in order to achieve that 400 meter depth?
Yep. Not that far. So it depends on where we are in the world. But here in California, which is the focus of most of our immediate work, we typically find that distance around 5 miles offshore.
Yep. And so you kind of describe the intake process. And so that you send the water through a pipe to shore. What type of, onshore facilities are needed? Because you had mentioned kind of the water factory, so to speak, that's associated with typical traditional desalination. So what's kind of the onshore component of ocean well?
So the footprint shoreside is pretty minimal. It's really just the control infrastructure, which can be put within something, broadly speaking, the size of one or two shipping containers. So very minimal indeed.
Absolutely fascinating. So this essentially could almost feed, I assume a pumping station would be the next infrastructure a water utility would need and just...
Yeah, that's correct. So the journey that we have undertaken over the last 7 years has really been concerned with creating the technology and mitigating the, let's say, previous shortcomings of conventional desalination. So there's been an awful lot of work of thinking through and engineering how we get that solution to work offshore. As we move the product water to shore with our first installations, which we refer to as water farms, each of those will look different depending on the offtake partner. But for the initial water farms that we are currently in discussions with, those typically are municipal water offtakers. And so we will look to build in conjunction with them some sort of shore crossing or additional conveyance capacity to get into their network. And that looks different in each location.
Is there a substantial permitting regime you have to go through in order to get these? Just kind of curious what the permitting regime looks like for doing something like this.
Yep. So there's a number of agencies that we engage with. And of course, the ocean has its own permitting environment. Typically adds about 3 or 4 additional agencies that we need to engage with. And depending on the distance from shore where the water farm is actually going to fall kind of dictates which set of those agencies we engage with. But our starting premise for the early water farms has essentially been to reach out to all agencies and have them tell us whether they think we are outside of their purview rather than make that determination ourselves. And that's part of our sort of general ethos as a company, which is to be as collaborative as possible, as early as possible. And I think that's one of the things that's really marked out the ocean well journey to this point, has been a very proactive desire to engage all stakeholders, particularly those that have had concern around any form of conventional desalination. And the reason for that is quite simple. We built this as a solution for California, which famously has had a number of challenges and concerns around conventional desalination. So has quite refined thinking around concerns and challenges that do need to be mitigated and solved for. And so the agencies are, you know, one set of that discussion and that equation, but oftentimes there's groups, sometimes from the environmental sector, that have a good understanding of those issues before the permitting agency may. And so we've sought to engage with them through our product development cycle to essentially say, you know, here's the solution we think works and solves for these challenges as we've understood them over the last 10, 20 years. Do you agree with that? Do you see other challenges? Do you see things that we have missed? How do you feel about this as a solution? And that's been quite an interesting part of our journey in and of itself, because one of the things that I think is misunderstood in some sectors of the permitting discussion is this notion of folks that are just generically anti-desal. And what we've learned with many of those groups is they're in fact not anti-desal at all. It's not that reductive or simplistic. They simply just don't want a technology that is simplistic is the wrong word, but there is a sense of feeling that technology has moved on substantially from when conventional desalination was deployed, and there must now be improved offerings that do not come with the environmental costs or land use requirements or the high energy costs that that conventional technology does.
I love the collaborative approach. And I should have mentioned earlier, it went through my mind, but I forgot. I love you calling it water farms. I think that's a great, great moniker for it. Can you talk a little more about the collaborative environment? You talked about collaboration with some of the stakeholders. I assume your outreach sounds like it's pretty broad. Can you just talk about generally how that outreach is going and who are the other types of stakeholders you're interfacing with?
Yeah, absolutely. So we, as a company, made a decision early on that, well, a couple of things. One, we were building this, as I say, as a solution for California, which is our home. So we're not really looking to force a technology or think through a solution purely in technological terms. And we really wanted that feedback. So collaboration was partly altruistic, partly collaborative, but partly self-serving. We needed to know what the full frame of the challenge and the problem was so that we could go and solve for it. And all of this type of technology has a long burn cycle, as I'm sure you're aware. So we don't want to get 5 years down the journey and find we've missed some key component that X or Y stakeholder would really like to see in it. So as part of that process, we created an outreach team with two extraordinary individuals, Kaelin Simon and Tim Quinn, who went out into Waterworld and met with essentially anybody who was interested and had previous focus on desalination or coastal issues to get their take and view. And those range, you know, across the gambit from small fisheries groups to large ocean concerns to environmental groups. And some of those are larger and more active than others. And so they're better resourced to engage with technologies and stories and nascent solutions of ours. And some are not. And so this was also something we had to learn and moderate along the journey was, you know, being willing to go openly and collaboratively talk to these entities and tooling up for that is one thing, but you also need to be resourced to have the appropriate conversation and meet that group where they are, which is not always as well resourced as you might imagine. And so they have to take priority views on what are the issues and technologies that they need to look at right now. Maybe we're one of those, maybe we're a little bit further down. So it's been a multi-year journey. We've engaged with over 100 different groups through California and the West. And generally speaking, we've had a pretty positive response and set of engagements there.
Yeah. So because this is really a first of a kind type of technology that is bringing desal another step forward. What challenges have you encountered for a technology of, for all intents and purposes, first impression?
So the first of a kind risk for technology of our type is a challenging one, as it is for any. For us, it is somewhat reduced in scope, fortunately, and that's really a function of design. So our solution is a modular, scalable architecture. Each ocean well pod produces 1 million gallons of water per pod, and those are then scaled into a water farm for a given capacity for a community. Maybe that's 10 MGD, maybe it's 50 MGD. But the first of a kind discussion is not the water farm itself. It is the individual pod. That immediately reduces the size of the problem some. It's still a material problem. And of course, operating in the ocean at 400 meters depth is a challenging, expensive undertaking in and of itself, which is to say testing and pilot prototypes are fairly consequential undertakings, more so than on-land technology development. That said, there is a large industry that is well-equipped that operates in this environment, namely oil and gas, that has solved for most of the technology and aspects that we use or envisage using around the water farm, separate to our own technology. So a large part of the water farm capital infrastructure, the offtake pipes, the power umbilicals, the communication systems, the pumps, the wetmate stab connectors, these large capital components have long well-established technology stories elsewhere, typically 5, 20, 30 years, and they have been proven for those durations. That solves another chunk of our first-of-a-kind risk and acceptance, and makes the challenge there more manageable, sort of breaking it into those bites. So that's sort of how we've approached it thus far, is to try and modularize what's a real first-of-a-kind risk that is specific to this technology, and what is a system component or subsystem that is in operation elsewhere, which we will use as part of our water farm, but does not, you know, benefit or need to be validated to technology readiness level 9 being the standard benchmark.
Yeah, terrific idea, borrowing from other sectors. I think the water industry needs more of that. I'd like to draw a connection, if I may, between your newness and I think your team's newness to the water sector, and how you've expanded beyond the water silo to borrow from other industries. And so before I ask my other questions, I'd like to just have you talk a little bit about the Ocean Well team and its newness to the water sector, and how you see you have brought kind of straight entrepreneurial spirit, but how you've kind of brought new ideas and a fresh eyesight here to the water sector. Could you just address that point real quick?
Absolutely. And I think that's true. I think it's also important for technological shifts like this. Having spent a decade or so in prototypical startup land, looking at all sorts of software and hardware technologies, and which have been successful and which have not, oftentimes the big impact comes from a perspective outside of itself, of the thing. And that itself, that form of collaboration is super important. So the Ocean Well team is largely made up of what I would describe as career switchers, folks that have, done something, oftentimes in engineering, in finance, in adjacent sectors, but not directly in water, but which have gotten to a stage where, we each individually, for one reason or another, see the urgency of the climate situation, but feel a particular affinity and connection to water and that intersection of the problem. And that has led to the assimilation of the team. And I think we also hunt for that outside perspective. It does help really bring a can-do, fresh perspective attitude. It brings perspective from different industries. One of our engineers is from the oil and gas sector, and that was very intentional. We wanted that expertise to understand how some of the components we need to engage with in the deep ocean work. And that's the go-to place for high competence in that engineering skill set. But I will say two members of our team are extremely well-established in water. I don't want to mischaracterize us at all. Tim Quinn, in particular, quite well-known in the California water scene, has a 30-year reputation in the industry. And our founder, Robert Bergstrom, founded Seven Seas Water, which, for those that are not familiar, is a conventional desalination business that operates in the Caribbean and is was listed on the New York Stock Exchange, is now owned by Morgan Stanley. But what was really interesting in that journey, and I think it informed Robert's second journey, if you like, here, was that through Seven Seas, he found he was able to cut in half the cost of water for those communities. And that, you know, that's a pretty profound objective and achievement for a business. And the insight of hydrostatic pressure and taking desalination down into the deep ocean, if we are successful with our product, our journey, and our partnerships, and can unlock that, has the opportunity to herald a similar impact for the cost of desalination water here in California and other regions. And I think that's a really important unlock. You know, as Robert likes to say, and I think, you know, this was struck me as a very important statement when we were having early conversations. You know, water is one of those fundamental elements. It's so important in so many different ways, but it can be a source of conflict. And wherever you take new water, that dissolves conflict and adds value effectively wherever it goes. So thinking about being able to add new water to the supply in an environmentally friendly, affordable, and scalable fashion is a very seductive proposition. And I think that's what has enabled us to pull in the talent and the team that we've been so lucky to assimilate to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the analogy. And the question I was going to ask is, you've mentioned you've developed this technology primarily in the California market for the California market. Mm-hmm. And so that you clearly identified a need of water scarcity. Can you just expand on the choice of California just very quickly? Why that was the premier market for you to develop this technology?
Yep. This is an important point, and it's a question that comes up many times, because rightly or wrongly, California has this reputation as a place that's difficult to deploy new water technologies. For us, the reasons were quite simple. One, it's our home, and we're building the thing to solve a problem, you know, starting here. Hopefully it has application worldwide. But second of all, that reputation itself is a key benchmark. If we can solve for California, and if we can clear that hurdle and satisfy the requirements of all stakeholders in the discussion, not just water managers or folks that want to end use the water, we think that enables us to solve for most locations and applications in the world. So it's one of those sort of prove it points, you know. If it is as good as you think it is, you know, let's stick our head in the lion's mouth and see. So that was partly the logic. I think also there was an aspect of serendipity, you know, being so fortunate to have some of the members of the team with the experience of California water that we do. They were instrumental in starting early discussions there. And, you know, Tim Quinn absolutely was a key driver in us looking at California first and having conversations with water managers there, I think earlier than we expected or thought we should. But because he has that perspective, having been one, it was really interesting to learn and understand how he had thought about desalination for 10, 20 plus years. And whilst, you know, have issue or don't have issue with the high energy use and the other costs, he just did not think it was a practical solution. And so because it was not going to be acceptable to the constituency, it's not an effective tool to solve the problem. So move on. When he met Ocean Well, you know, you go down the list, you get a tick on all of the challenges. And he was like, okay, well, this is pretty potentially seismic. It opens up the promise of desalination without the costs. So that led to some early discussions with some progressive thinking water managers that were open to engaging with an early technology company of our type, and hearing the work we'd done for 7 years, what we thought were the challenges, how we had solved those, how the technology had been packaged, if you like, both from a physical thing and as well as a business proposition. And the response there was quite strong resonance. And so from that, those initial discussions, which initially were just intended as an initial briefing, and we'll, you know, come back at some point, but they quickly evolved into what we now refer to as the California Working Group, which is a group of now 23 water agencies that kindly have lent their time and their teams to engage with us, understand all of the sort of nuanced issues as we go down the journey to bring the first water farm to existence. And to, you know, then hopefully become a partner and deploy some of that water. So that's why California, and actually we, for the last year or so, our entire focus, our strategy for the company was called California First, Environment Forward, which was really the encapsulation of all of these notions. You know, if we can get to California first and we can solve for these environmental issues, produce a new supply that doesn't have the environmental costs that conventional desalination does, then that's a worthy thing.
Well, Jonathan, you've been absolutely fantastic today. I love the technology. I love the way you've described it and kind of the problems it solves. Before we say goodbye, do you have a leave behind message?
Sure. Well, thanks for hosting, Dave. It's been a really fun conversation. I think the leave behind is really to open minds. If, you know, if you're a water manager or someone in the industry that's curious about new technologies for supply or wrestling with a supply issue, consider offshore, consider both floating and deep ocean desalination. And if we can be helpful in that education process, separate and apart from whether it's you know, a partnership thing, please absolutely do reach out. We're very happy to share our insights and the work that we've done over the last 7 years or so on this topic.
Terrific. Well, Jonathan, again, thanks so much for coming on. For those who want to find out more about you, about Oceanwell, where can they go to get that information?
The website, oceanwellwater.com, or if you want to connect with me personally, please reach out on LinkedIn. I'm pretty easy to find there. Or my email address is jonathan@oceanwellwater.com.
Awesome. Well, Jonathan, again, thanks so much. Look forward to seeing these get put into operation, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dave. Take care.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Absolutely a great interview by Jonathan. If your mind is thinking Oceanwell has game-changing technology for the water sector, well, you're not alone. I cannot wait to see how Oceanwell takes off. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That's our landing page at the Bluefield Research website. Again, longtime listeners know that Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, we get a home on the web at the Bluefield Research site. So you can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com. And you can sign up for the newsletter at that aforementioned landing page as well. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Water Works Association. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. Again, we have no podcasts coming out in July, so we'll see you in August. Thanks so much for listening. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice
or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.